Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sing hallelujah, she's alive, but alas, unwell. Princess Kate finally is allowed to speak and address her nation. And murder most foul, mass murder most foul, as the number of fatalities in the shootout in Moscow in the Crocus Theater reaches almost 200 people, plus all the wounded, the mutilated and the maimed. Will be deep diving into this ghastly terrorist crime. Not that you've heard it described as such in either the UK or the US media. Terrorism's okay, you see, as long as it's directed against the right kind of innocent civilian. Fasten your seatbelt. This is going to be a particularly bumpy night, as Betty Davis once said, because this is the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, we're not really royalists here at the Mother of All Talk Shows. Indeed, some of us are outright Republicans, including me. We're not like those other sticker Valentines, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democratic Party, whose spokespeople, all of whom, have attacked me and the mother of all talk shows in the last 24 hours. And these other sticker Valentines in the Daily Express, is that still coming out? And the Daily Mail, and the Daily Telegraph, all these royalist, fawning sycophants are outraged, they say, at the interviews that we here on the Mother of All Talk Shows have done in the last couple of weeks, expressing our concern about the whereabouts and the state of health of the Princess of Wales. Now, we're not royalists, but we kind of like our Princess Kate, and we were worried about her, and we had every right to worry about her, as it turns out. She had not been seen in public since Christmas Day, and spring is here. She had been the subject of at least 2, maybe 3 fake photoshopped images to try to show us that she was alive and well. Well, we now know that she is alive. We now know that she is not well. And so, on behalf of all here, Republican or Royalist, at the Mother of All Talk Shows, let me express this. We have the deepest sympathy for Princess Kate, the Princess of Wales, particularly her, because we like her in the royal family. We consider her a gracious and beautiful lady. We were concerned about her then. We're concerned about her now. We pray to God that she recovers fully and swiftly from the illness that she is now suffering, which appears to have been revealed by abdominal surgery a month or two ago. We wish that the royal family had more honesty and candor and, well, dependability in their communications. It's they, not us, who have been struck off the Associated Press and Reuters and other reputable agencies. And it's they, not us, who will never be trusted again by those agencies, because they don't like being fed a dodgy bill of goods. And that's what these photographs were, a dodgy bill of goods. Now that we know that this young mother, this gracious and beautiful lady, is suffering from cancer, we all pray and wish her well. We wish for her full and speedy recovery. But we won't be lectured to by sycophants with checkbooks who purchase things. You see, we had every right to be concerned about Princess Kate because some of us are old enough to remember her mother-in-law. We know what can happen. We've watched The Crown on Netflix. We know what can happen to individuals of the royal blood, never mind individuals who marry in to the House of Windsor. We know what happened to Lady Diana. We're determined that it shouldn't be allowed to happen to Princess Kate. Now, murder most foul is what took place in Moscow this week in a shopping mall in the Crocus Theatre in Moscow at the hands of a terrorist group, all four of whom, of the shooters, have now been apprehended, and 11 people are now under arrest in connection with the cowardly murder of currently more than 180 people. Innocent people, unarmed people, civilian people. During Ramadan, when it is actually forbidden to make an aggressive attack, Muslims are allowed during Ramadan only to defend themselves from attack. They are forbidden to mount an aggressive, offensive attack, even against an armed adversary. So that was my first whiff of how badly the swiftly distributed American, UK, Western lie that this heinous terrorist mass murder had been carried out in the name of Islam. We never believed it. Some of you may have been fooled, but you'd have to be up early in the morning to fool the likes of me. You see, I've been through many a false flag operation in the course of my lifetime. I saw the United States drawn into the Vietnam War, which killed millions of people, on a false flag operation. I've seen lots of false flag operations that were called conspiracy theories, even though now everybody accepts that they were true. I saw with my eyes the assassination of the late and great President John F. Kennedy. It was a lone gunman at first, a lone, unhinged, deranged gunman who might even have ties to Cuba, might even have ties to Moscow. There were no others involved. There was no conspiracy, they said. Now you won't find anybody anywhere, anywhere in the United States, anywhere in the world, who any longer believes that Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, killed President Kennedy on Elm Street in that nightmare in November of 1963. I saw with my own eyes Senator Robert F. Kennedy being murdered on his way to being anointed as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate in California in 1968. I saw with my eyes the murder of the Reverend Martin Luther King. I saw with my own eyes the murder of the great Malcolm X. I saw all these things. I heard all the official narratives, and all of them turned out to be a pack of lies. So I don't automatically accept anything, especially when it comes out within minutes of an act of mass murder from the country that hasn't yet solved the assassination of their own president in broad daylight as long ago as 1963. So when the US and the UK and others swiftly tried to reassure me that it was only ISIS that carried out this mass murder in Moscow, I knew automatically that they were lying. And now I am working back. And here's what I'm finding. I'm finding, first of all, that no one has explained the unannounced visit of President Barack Obama to meet British political and security officials in 10 Downing Street 3 days before this terrorist crime was carried out. Working further back, I discovered that Victoria Nuland, that harbinger of death, that angel of death, who, if she comes anywhere near you, be sure a civil war is coming in your country. I saw her with my own eyes promise the Russians some nasty surprises in the next few weeks and months. I'm working further back, and I discover that the White House spokesman, John Kirby, announced that American citizens had been warned to stay away from crowded places, including shopping malls and theaters in the great city of Moscow, the greatest city in Europe, the capital of the largest country on the earth. And I was never that great at mathematics, but I know that one and one makes two. I know that one and two makes three. I know that one and three makes four. And so I have four pieces of evidence in my mind that leads me to believe that the United States, that the NATO allies and their proxy servant, the state of Ukraine, the remaining state of Ukraine, were in fact responsible for this mass murder. And we will be talking in the course of this show to the great Scott Ritter, who I think has reached a somewhat similar conclusion, though knowing him will have dived deeper than I have had the time to dive. Because I'm involved in all kinds of politics, not just international. Now that I'm a Member of Parliament again, I have domestic, constituency, national, as well as international responsibilities. And I'm doing my best to live up to those responsibilities on all fronts. I've spoken in Parliament 3 times in the last 10 days. That's more times than most MPs speak in an entire year. 3 speeches in 10 days. I hope you've seen them. If you haven't, look them up, because they reflect this new multidimensional set of responsibilities that I have. My maiden speech in Parliament, there it is on the screen, was overwhelmingly about Rochdale and about Britain and its perilous economic situation under the uniparty, ironclad consensus of Conservative and Labour, that tightly clenched set of buttocks, the left and right of which are impossible to discern from the other. In my second speech, I addressed, amongst other things, my overwhelming belief that we discussed last Wednesday here on the Mother of All Talk Shows, that this pier, built of the skulls and the bones and the ruins of the houses of the owners of the skulls and the bones being built in Gaza, is intended not for the purpose of bringing in aid to a starving, sickening, desperately thirsty, freezing cold population, but is instead intended to facilitate the mass deportation of those people who are starving, sickening and dying of thirst. I suppose the Daily Express would call that a conspiracy theory. But like many conspiracy theories, it is founded in fact. It is founded in evidence. It is founded in the conduct of that most heinous of occupation armies, the army that calls itself the Israel Defense Force, who have been breaking all new norms in the bestial, fascistic oppression of the people who lie at their feet, at their mercy, now extended even to mass rape of Palestinian women detainees. You don't have to take my word for that, incidentally. Some of you, I know, will not. I refer you to the Jerusalem Post. I refer you to the United States official in the Jerusalem Post making that allegation. People in the Al-Shifa Hospital report that groups of Palestinian men, groups of between 8 and 12 men at a time, were being led away by Israeli soldiers, followed by a ferocious burst of gunfire and then silence as the bodies were taken away. I'm talking about mass executions in a hospital. Now, do you remember, are you old enough to remember, approximately 150 days ago, when Israel denied and called a blood libel the idea that they would bomb a hospital? You remember it? You remember they said it was a misfiring Hamas rocket? You remember they said it was an anti-Semitic lie that they would attack a hospital? Do you know that 150 days later, there is not a single hospital in all of Gaza that they have not attacked? Do you know there's scarcely one brick standing upon another in the hospitals of the Gaza Strip that have not been attacked openly, without any denial, on camera? Not just the buildings, but the interiors, but the patients, the staff, the doctors, however senior, however eminent, who've been murdered inside these hospitals. You see the problem with normalizing war crimes? You see the problem with normalizing genocide? The main problem is that once you've accepted it once, you will incrementally accept it happening over and over again and in ever more crazed, inhuman examples of this kind of mass murder, torture, and rape, which is taking place at the hands of one of Britain and America's closest allies. A country, Israel, which is armed by us, funded by us, propagandized for by us, diplomatically protected by us. And of course, the mass murders in the hospital are only a part of the unfolding genocidal crimes that you can see behind me on your screen right now. And it is going on and on and on. For all the faff about ceasefires, humanitarian pauses, prisoner exchanges, during all of that guff, children and their mothers and their fathers, sisters, brothers, uncles, aunts, grandparents are still daily being massacred. And the grim reaper of famine and disease cuts a swathe through those who somehow evade, escape the scything, hot lead from shot and shell. You better stay tuned. This is going to be one hell of a show. It's the mother of all talk shows.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
One man who knows a thing or two about the power of propaganda, but who also knows how to stand up to propaganda, how to fight it, and how to win against it, is Professor David Miller. I say professor, although he is a professor, he's not currently working as a professor because he was unfairly dismissed from that on a bogus set of accusations that I'm sure he's itching to tell you about now. He is the producer of Palestine Declassified. He is an author and quite the political commentator. Professor Miller, you'll always be Professor Miller to me. For those few in the audience who don't know what happened to you and what happened next, kindly summarise what happened.
I will do. But first, George, I want to say congratulations for being elected to Parliament once again. A great achievement.
Thank you very much, Professor.
What happened to me was that I was sacked on October the 1st, 2021, after a three-year campaign by Zionists against me, who had complained about my research, my evidence-based research on the Zionist movement, and in particular on the research which I had done, which showed that the Zionist movement is a key player behind the spread of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim prejudice in the UK and in other places too. That campaign was run by student groups. It was run by academics in my own university. It was run by academics around the world. More than 100 members of the Houses of Commons and Lords signed a letter demanding for me to be sacked. There were debates in Parliament calling for me to be gone, and I was gone. And the university sacked me as a result of that campaign. I appealed. They denied my appeal. And then I took them to court, to the industrial tribunal, to the employment tribunal. And that sat from the 16th of October last year, just 9 days after the launch of what's called Al-Aqsa floods, when the Palestinian resistance broke out of Gaza. And so in that kind of context, I was grilled and cross-examined for 2 days, 2.5 days in court. And the university's witnesses likewise were grilled and cross-examined. The university was found to have wrongly dismissed me, to have not properly investigated the charges against me, and to have not properly evaluated the investigation which they did. But they were also found to have sacked me, not just because dismissed me wrongfully, they had also sacked me on the basis of my anti-Zionist views. They had claimed that the reason they'd sacked me was because I'd said things about students which were inappropriate. What I'd said was that I'd be attacked and complained about by Zionist student groups. Those are the words I used. And the court determined that that wasn't the case. They hadn't sacked me for that reason. They had sacked me specifically because I had anti-Zionist views. And if I hadn't had those anti-Zionist views and I'd done everything else that I did, they wouldn't have sacked me. So this was a tremendous breakthrough because it establishes in law for the first time that anti-Zionist views are protected under the Equality Act 2010, but also therefore that anti-Zionist views are not racist, that there is a distinction to be drawn between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, a distinction which the government of Israel has tried to abolish and obliterate for the last half century. So that's what happened to me. I came out of that entirely justified and got my name cleared. And we now await to see how much money the university is going to be forced to give me as a result.
Now, it's very odd, isn't it, as you describe it? I mean, in a sense, how could being opposed to Israel and being opposed to the ideology, the political ideology of Zionism, make you ipso facto guilty of anti-Semitism? If you think about it, it's absurd. If I hated Saudi Arabia, would I be guilty of hating Muslims? If I hated the Soviet Union and communism, would I be guilty of hating Russians, hating the people of the Soviet Union? Ditto Nazism, if you were an anti-Nazi, would you have been actually hating Germans or loving Germans, wishing to see them liberated from the hateful political ideology? Ideologies are man-made. Religions, if you believe in them, as I do, are made by God. Maybe God can be criticized. Men definitely can be criticized. It's very odd that an exception ought to have ever been considered right in the case of Zionism, isn't it?
Well, it is odd, but it's an exception which the Israelis have spent an inordinate amount of time and resources and money on putting into place. They've been doing this since at least 1972, when the foreign minister, Abba Iban, said that anti-Zionism was the, quote, new anti-Semitism. And that is the phrase which they have used ever since then. And they have tried to bludgeon and intimidate and bully people into accepting their definition. And it's currently codified in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism, where that the distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is deliberately broken down. They've then attempted to impose that everywhere that they can. And you'll, of course, recall, famously, they were able to impose it upon the Labour Party and many other places in the UK, including on my university. Indeed, my university itself offered to the complainant, the head of the Zionist student group, that she should pause her complaint while the university decided whether it would change its rules and introduce the IHRA, which it duly did. And then it duly reinvestigated me and found, in any case, that I was not guilty of any anti-Semitism at all.
So what's going to happen next? They're not going to offer you your job back. I'm not even sure you'd want it. They're going to have to compensate you handsomely, and it's cost the university a pretty penny all round already, I hazard a guess. Will it be satisfying to you to simply walk away with enough money to fund your research and your academic work elsewhere? Or are you more interested in the fact that all academics, all employees, all candidates, perhaps, for political parties, are now effectively protected by the legal battle that you won?
Well, the purpose of doing this, of course, was to clear my name. I'd been accused of anti-Semitism. The university had employed a QC twice to investigate everything that I'd ever said, practically, back to 2013. A QC had determined that there was nothing I'd ever said which was anti-Semitic. But nevertheless, the cloud of anti-Semitism has followed me around, because the Zionists never cease to accuse me of such things, as I'm sure you're aware of yourself when you're accused of similar things. So it was about clearing my name, but it was mainly, the main purpose of taking this case was to establish that anti-Zionist views are and should be protected under the law. And this now becomes available to people, anyone in employment across the UK, to protect them from being sacked for the same reason. But it does more than that. It drives a coach and horses through the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition, and it will become increasingly difficult for the Israelis to impose their views on that all across the world as a result of this victory. So the whole point of this was to win a strategic victory against Zionism, and we have done that, I think, handsomely. The question is, well, what happens next? Zionism is, as you know, and as one can see in the daily pictures that we see from Gaza, in a crisis. Zionism is on the verge, I would say, of a collapse. The whole question we have to face now is, what happens when Zionism collapses? How do we move towards de-Zionizing, yes, Palestine, but also the rest of the world? I mean, the Zionists have a huge operation in the UK, in the US, in Germany, in France, and many other countries. And their brand of racism will not go away quietly. It will have to be piece by piece dismantled so that the Zionist movement itself is taken to pieces, and that Jewish communal organizations, for example, can be de-Zionized and put back to their proper purpose, which is to represent ordinary Jews and not to be vectors of racist Zionist ideology.
Although Jewish organizations are entitled to have any political posture, stripe that they like, but the rest of us are entitled to judge them for the political posture and stripe that they've liked, don't we?
That's right. I mean, the problem is, of course, that Jewish communal organizations, which do not represent the wealth of views amongst ordinary Jews, are simply denying them having the right to have places of worship, places to go for education, places of political representation, student groups. It's very difficult for Jews who are non-Zionist or anti-Zionist to find anywhere to represent them, because many, almost all of the communal organizations are Zionist. So we need to move towards a position where it's recognized that Zionism is racism, and that as a result, we are opposed to Zionism, just like we are to anti-Muslim racism or anti-Black racism. It's a similar kind of idea. The University of Bristol itself has on its website a commitment that we should be in favor of what they call eradicating racism. I very much support that view, and it's a view which I think should be applied to Zionism as well.
Professor David Miller, thanks for coming back on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Good to see you again in victory.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Those who've been following the Mother of All Talk Shows throughout its latest incarnation, here on screen as opposed to just on radio, will already know my respect, admiration and affection for our next guest, our very own Texas Rose. Back in the USA, it's the one and only Rachel Blevins. Rachel, welcome back to the Mother of All Talk Shows. You are a popular guest and much missed. Lovely to see you again. I'm just wondering what the attitude of the United States is to the terrorist atrocity visited on the people of Moscow, that great city where both you and I were and have been often visitors, and you working there for a time must have been particularly painful for you to watch what unfolded at the Crocus Theatre.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me back on, George. Always happy to be here. And you're right, watching the terrorist attack that unfolded just a couple of days ago in Moscow was incredibly hard to see the images and the videos that were out there. And at the same time, when it comes to the pure evil that was carried out, I'm glad that we were able to see it firsthand. I'm glad that we were able to see just what was done and that there was nothing hidden there. There was nothing that was censored, because the world needs to know that this is the attack that was carried out, that this is, you know, targeting dozens of Russians, that there were thousands there who were at stake. And even when it comes to the latest, what we're hearing on the perpetrators, what Russia has said so far, what is being circulated on social media, one of the most notable responses came from the White House, and that was National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. Before the bodies were even cold yet, before we even knew how many people were dead, he was standing there at a press conference, you said, oh, well, we know it's not Ukraine. We have no indication that Ukraine was involved. And it makes you wonder, for any country, but especially for the United States, knowing how much control and involvement the Biden administration has with Ukraine and with the Kiev regime, why were they so quick to immediately come out and say, oh, well, we know it wasn't Ukraine? And then shortly after that, you have these reports that ISIS has now taken responsibility for this. And if there's anything we've learned about the United States and its proxies and who it has control over, we know that it has a number of ties to not just Kiev directly, but it also has those ties to ISIS. So it was almost too convenient of a plot to come out and to have everything line up just like that. Now, obviously, there's still a lot that we don't know. There's still a lot that is being investigated. But when it comes to the response here in the U.S., I think that many Americans were shocked to see this unfold in Moscow. There's some of those who are going to be anti-Russian who are going to say, yeah, it's about time that we see attacks like this in Russia. But it's also important to remember that we had Miss Victoria Nuland, who, although she's resigning, is still speaking out and still very anti-Russian herself. And she was warning that there was going to be some sort of what she called surprises coming to Russia. And this horrific, heinous attack targeting only civilians with no military aims seems like exactly what Victoria Nuland would have been forecasting if only she had known.
Well, there's been remarkably little public state sympathy expressed to the Russian people who suffered this mass terrorist outrage. The only building done up in the Russian colors in commemoration, in solidarity, was the Burj in Dubai. It's the only one I saw in the colors of Russia. Only in Belgrade did I see any mass outpouring of amongst football fans of sympathy. If this had been an attack, God forbid, on people in London or people in Paris or people in New York, the attitude would have been very different. And it's yet more evidence, as if we needed much more, that the attitude to terrorism on the part of Western countries is very much dependent on whose terrorists they were and whose victims they were. Isn't that true?
Oh, I would agree. Absolutely. I mean, where is Berlin? Where is New York with all of their light shows that you typically see when there is a horrific tragedy like the one that was carried out in Moscow? And I think it just goes to show that over the last several years, but over the last 2 years especially, you have seen this increase in Russophobia here in the West, where people have been taught not just that Vladimir Putin is bad and he's some kind of evil villain that we need to get rid of, but they have been taught to hate the Russian people, to believe that they are not worthy of the same sympathy that anyone in the West would have been worthy of if a tragedy like that was carried out here. And I think here in the U.S., we need to be asking ourselves, why are we still not just supporting Ukraine, but why are we still supporting this ongoing proxy war against Russia? Do we really want to see World War III with not just a nuclear armed superpower, but with notably Russia and their arsenal? Is that the end game that we want here? Because for the last 2 years now, the Biden administration has done everything in its power to target Russia without directly going to war, right? They've armed Ukraine to the teeth. They've sent them plenty of funding. But at the same time, they have also carried out this sanctions war against Russia. They've made them the most sanctioned nation in the world. And they've done everything they can through the mainstream media, through the speeches that we've heard from the Biden administration, to convince the American people that Russia is bad and that these are the people that we need to be targeting. But 2 years down the road, who's hurting from this? Well, the Americans are hurting in some ways. Our supposed allies over in the EU and the UK, they are the people who are hurting. And the Russians are continuing to become stronger on their end. They're continuing to fortify their economy and to strengthen their alliances with other countries. And so the American people need to be coming to this point of asking, why were we dragged into this campaign to begin with? Because it's certainly not benefiting us, and it's not hurting the people that we were supposed to be targeting. And then they need to be asking themselves why they were supposed to be targeting those people in the first place.
Now, President Biden declined to call President Putin to offer his sympathies on this terrorist atrocity, which shows you how low the White House has sunk. What about the next president, Donald Trump? Has he had anything to say about it?
Yeah, you know, we haven't heard too much from Donald Trump. I mean, when it comes to what he has said about Russia and about Ukraine specifically, he still is at this point of acting like he is going to come in and to fix everything in a matter of 24 hours, which we all know is simply not the case. But he obviously is going to do everything to present himself as the opposite of Biden, even though we know that when it comes to Trump and Biden, they have a number of policies that are the same, not just when it comes to past support for Ukraine and past tensions and current tensions with Russia, but also when it comes to their support, the both of them, for the ongoing genocide that Israel is committing in Gaza. And so I think when it comes down to it, you know, we look at the options that the American people are supposed to have when they're getting ready to vote in a presidential election come November, and we realize that they have much more in common on foreign policy than they actually do when it comes to the differences. And so it's surprising to me that Trump isn't doing more to try to cast himself as the anti-Biden all around, but I think because he has that established track record of 4 years already in office, and people kind of know what to expect from him, and they know that if and when he comes back into office for a second term, that he is likely to be in a position where he may not provide as much support for Ukraine, but he still is going to continue those tensions with Russia.
Now, the United States is now in the electoral cycle. Biden now seems certain to be the Democratic candidate, Trump to be certain to be the Republican candidate. Are the polls moving a bit, or is Donald Trump still well ahead?
You know, it depends on which poll you look at. It seems like in a lot of cases they're neck and neck, and the headlines have been all over the place. The most key place where Trump is leading, though, are in these key swing states, right? We have just a handful of states here in the U.S. that are known as swing states, which essentially decide the election at the end of the day. You can assume that states like California and Texas are going to go for the Democrats and the Republicans, respectively. But when it comes down to what we've seen there, I think a lot of it is going to depend on whether or not Americans are actually feeling energized and they want to go out and vote, right? Do they think that anything meaningful is going to change? A lot of that revolves around the economy. Of course, that's always going to be a major issue in any election. So they may look at Trump and say, hey, the 4 years that he was in office, the economy was better. I wasn't struggling to pay bills as much as I am now with the 4 years that Joe Biden has been in office. Of course, the question then becomes, what can Trump do if he gets in office and really is targeting the economy? But when it comes to foreign policy, in the past, we haven't really seen that as a major issue. But I think right now, when you're looking at the fact that we are in a situation where the suffering in Gaza is just unimaginable right now, and the U.S. is making that possible, they are enabling genocide, and they should be held accountable for it. They look at people like Trump and Biden, and they say, wait a second, they're very similar here. And they also look at other people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and they go, oh, wait a second, they're similar as well. So there is very much a void here in the U.S., a need for a candidate to step up who is truly anti-war, not just when it comes to questioning the support that we're sending to Ukraine, but also when it comes to standing up to Israel, standing up to the U.S. support that they give Israel, and forcing a ceasefire in Gaza, forcing the aid to be allowed in, because that is something that they desperately need right now.
Now, lastly, you know Moscow as I do. What do you think the impact on Russian public opinion this outrage in Moscow is likely to have? Is it likely to bring the Russians closer together or begin to shatter their national unity?
Well, you know, it was interesting that the U.S. put out that statement that they did back on March 7th ahead of the presidential elections, calling for Americans to steer clear of any public gatherings. And that was, of course, over the time of the election. That's what they claimed that they were talking about. But when you look at what actually happened, whether the U.S. had any forewarning of that, and you look at the outpouring of support coming from the Russian people, I know that they had hundreds of people, it was reported, that were going to blood banks immediately saying, hey, I am here to donate. What can I give? You also had people that lived around the Crocus City Hall who saw police officers and rescue workers out there, and they were bringing them tea and coffee and food and everything that they could to help out. And so I think at the end of the day, this is more than likely to bring people together, just as everything else that has targeted Russia, that has led to the killing of Russians, it has continued to make the country stronger. And so I think that that's what we're likely to see here. I mean, we are seeing a very strong response from President Putin, from the Russian government, in targeting these perpetrators, not just finding them, but bringing them to justice, getting as many of the answers out of them as they can. And so I think that the Russian people are likely to see this and to realize that their government takes it seriously and that they do not want to see the mass killing of Russians happen again.
Rachel, as always, brilliant. Thank you for joining us again on the Mother of All Talk Shows. It's a very busy show tonight. 44,000 people have already voted. You've still got more than half an hour still to vote. Let's make this a world record Mother of All Talk Shows poll, shall we? Coming up after the break, it is former Marine Corps intelligence officer, former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq, a man who's forgotten more about war and the politics of war than most of the ministers of defense in Western countries put together. Stay tuned. I'll be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
The one and only Scott Ritter, the maestro, the master of all he surveys on the military political level. Back after too long. Scott Ritter, wonderful to see you again. Naturally, I want to concentrate on what happened in Moscow and who did what and what will happen next. But if we do have a moment towards the end, I would like to ask you about tomorrow's Security Council vote and the new resolution that has been tabled. But start with Moscow, if you will. That it was mass murder, most foul. Most people, not all, alas, could agree. The murdering and maiming of hundreds of people, unarmed, civilian people, young and old, men and women, in a concert hall would ordinarily bring down the righteous indignation and wrath of all right-thinking people, but as always, it depends who the victims were and who the perpetrators might have been, so far as some people are concerned. Who did it, do you think? What happens next?
Right now, the evidence does point to the involvement of Ukrainian intelligence. There's very strong evidence to back up that that assertion. The Russians, from what I understand, the Russians were tracking this vehicle from the moment it left Moscow. They could have stopped it at Moscow, but they let it go because they were also tracking the cell phones, and they were monitoring these cell phones as they made repeated phone calls into Ukraine, where they were connected with entities on the Ukrainian side of the border who were arranging to have a safe passage through the Russian-Ukrainian border. And that just directly implicates the Ukrainian government, because you need the complicity of the Ukrainian border services and that they would have to coordinate with higher authorities. And we also know that there's connectivity between the so-called International Legion of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, particularly the part of the Legion that's controlled by Ukrainian intelligence, and the Central Asian Republics. And that connectivity is also linked to the ongoing efforts by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to use the Central Asian Republics as a, as a means of putting pressure on Russia, also to use the immigrants. There's a large number of immigrants who work in Russia as a sea of fish amongst which intelligence operatives can swim. We did the same thing in Baghdad in the 1990s using the Kurdish population there as a sea amongst which the CIA, the MI6, and the Israeli Mossad fish could swim. And the same thing's happening in Russia today, where these immigrant populations are being used by foreign intelligence to find disaffected persons who will provide transportation support, who will provide logistics support, who will provide housing support, et cetera. So it appears that the CIA, at a minimum, provided infrastructure support to the Ukrainian intelligence. But we also should never forget that the CIA, since 2022, through their Special Activities Center, which is mandated by an act of Congress, by the way, to carry out deniable covert operations, including unconventional warfare, guerrilla warfare. These would also be called acts of terrorism, given what they do to disrupt civilian life for political purposes. And the CIA, the Special Activity Center, has been doing this work in Ukraine since 2022. And there's no reason to believe that suddenly they would have stopped doing this. We know that they have coordinated with the Ukrainian intelligence to penetrate Russian soil for the purpose of carrying out espionage, sabotage, direct action attacks. And again, what transpired here was a act of, it was politicized direct action designed to undermine the authority of the Russian government, to undermine the authority of Vladimir Putin. This was not an ISIS attack. First of all, the way it came out through a press service. ISIS normally releases reports about attacks that it was directly involved in through their central branch. But this was done through the press service, which means that it's after the fact that ISIS is saying these people were motivated by ISIS, so we're going to take credit for it. But if you take a look at the photographs that they use, when was the last time you saw ISIS martyrs blur their face? They don't blur their face because they don't care, because they're dead. These guys blurred their face because they were hoping to escape. When was the last time you had an ISIS attack say, we're going to carry out this attack and then we're going to try and get away, that we're doing it for money, not for a desire to become a martyr? ISIS was a deliberate cover story crafted by Ukrainian intelligence to mislead. And I believe the United States is involved, because the first thing the United States did before anybody knew anything is said, ISIS did this. They didn't give any. Ukraine had nothing to do with this, they said. And as Maria Zakharova has pointed out, how do you know this? I mean, you haven't even solved the Kennedy murders yet, and you're coming out and saying you know who was responsible for the Crocus attack. I'll just make it as clear as I can. This was a Ukrainian intelligence operation that I believe was aided and abetted by the Central Intelligence Agency, because the United States is at war with Russia. And I want to repeat that one more time just so people understand the gravity of what I'm saying. The United States is at war with Russia. It's a covert war. It's a deniable war, but it's a war nonetheless, and Russia's on to this. And if you're going to go to sleep tonight resting easy, don't. You need to be scared to death about what's to come, because no nation will take an attack like this on their territory lying down. And when the Russians find out, as they will, to the extent to which Ukraine was involved, they already have the evidence, and to which Ukraine was assisted by the United States and, may I say, your secret intelligence service, there will be hell to pay. We're talking about the potential of global thermonuclear war, because that's where this leads. That's where this leads. That's where war with Russia leads. And if you're not scared to death, then there's something wrong with you.
There were a number of reasons to immediately doubt the ISIS cover story. The first being just how immediately the ISIS cover story was circulated and from whence it was circulated. As Zakharova said, you don't even know who killed the Kennedys in the 1960s, but you know who carried out and who didn't carry out a mass terror attack within hours in Moscow. So the speed with which ISIS were supposedly taking credit or being blamed was the first reason to suspect it. The sight of someone taking the Shahada with his left hand, his dirty hand, was, of course, a second reason to doubt that these fellows were Muslims at all. The third reason was that, as you put it, they did not intend to die. And ISIS operators do intend to die. That's the purpose for which they're doing it, to get to heaven and all the rest. The fourth reason was that they were headed for the Ukraine when they were eventually stopped in their tracks. So like you, I discount the ISIS theory so anxiously and immediately promoted by Western media outlets and Western politicians. That leaves who? That leaves what answer to the ancient question, cui bono? Who else does it leave except Ukraine, the United States, and God forbid the United Kingdom? But why did they do it, Scott, if it were them?
I mean, we need to get more. First of all, I think we need to just take one step back and say that the Russians are doing an investigation that's ongoing, and many of these questions will be answered. I've seen some of the interrogation videotapes, and I will go on record here saying that I condemn the CIA for the torture that we used against Al-Qaeda suspects, and I condemn Russia for the torture that they're using to interrogate the people. It's Russia's business. I'm not a Russian citizen. Only the Russian citizens can hold the Russian government accountable. But as a former intelligence officer, I would tell you that's not the ideal way to interrogate. But Russia operates from a different book. If this was Americans doing this, I would condemn them wholeheartedly because Americans shouldn't torture, and I would never condone it. And I can't condone Russia doing it as well. So I just want to go on record as saying that I don't condone the use of torture to gain information.
I'm with you on that 100%.
And one of the reasons is that you can't trust it. But the Russians have their own methods, and I'm familiar with one of the methods they use, which is to ask a question, get an answer, and then immediately confront the person answering with the lie, that they just told a lie. And you see that these people didn't know that the Russians had their cell phones, and they were being asked questions, and then the Russians asked a counter question, and they pretended they didn't know. The Russians showed them the cell phone, and suddenly their memory is jarred because that was a phone call they just had moments before their arrest. The Russians know exactly what's going on. I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the conclusions that Russia has drawn. And I don't know if this was an attack designed to take place pre-election, meaning to disrupt the election. It would have been better for the Ukrainians had this happened pre-election, because it would have created in their minds the opportunity for people to question Putin's leadership, etc. So I don't know if this was an attack that was planned to happen before the election, but because of operational issues took place after. Because at some point in time, when you're doing a deniable operation of this nature, you let them into the wild, and then they're on their own. They may adhere to a timetable, they may not. They will do the action when they can. Or this could have been something that was deliberately planned to take place after the election to, again, try to undermine Vladimir Putin. But the Ukrainians right now are in desperate straits, extraordinarily desperate straits. They and the United States and Great Britain have always banked not on a Ukrainian victory, but on this war dragging out so long that it creates economic problems for Russia and domestic political problems for Vladimir Putin that could lead to a Moscow Maidan moment. That's the ultimate objective of everything the CIA and the British are doing. And when you are confronted with a collapsing situation on the front lines and an America that can't get its act together when it comes to whether we're going to provide support or not for the Ukrainians, sometimes intelligence services will seek to, you know, push the envelope, so to speak. There is also a possibility that the CIA and the British trained the Ukrainians in the art of covert, direct action, unconventional warfare, but did not have a hand in this operation, meaning that this is some sort of a rogue Ukrainian operation, because we have word that the United States has told the Ukrainians to back off, for instance, the strategic campaign against attacking Russian oil production centers and oil storage facilities. So the United States is not looking for an escalation. The Ukrainians are looking for an escalation. The only way Ukraine survives is to create a situation that NATO is compelled to intervene. I'll say it one more time. The only way that Ukraine survives is to create a situation that compels NATO to intervene, and that's what the Ukrainians are trying to do. They will continue to provoke the Russians over and over and over again in an effort to get a Russian overreaction and, therefore, some sort of NATO intervention. That's the goal. That's the cui bono. That's why this is all about Ukraine, not about anybody else.
The signs are that a big reaction, whether an overreaction, depends on your point of view. A big reaction is in the air, on its way right now. The largest bombing raids of the war appear to be underway. Will they be common or garden bomb attacks on industrial plant and transport infrastructure and so on? Or might the political leadership of Ukraine, hitherto not attacked as a matter of deliberate policy by Russia, will they now themselves be in the firing line?
I think that it's inevitable that at some point in time, the Ukrainian leadership will be in the firing line. I mean, it's hard to tell. The Russians are the ones responsible for targeting, not Scott Ritter. I happen to think that tonight we might see a continuation of the campaign to destroy the critical infrastructure of Ukraine, that the gloves have come off and the lights are going out forever. And also, you might see more attacks on, for instance, buried natural gas storage to destroy, literally just take down Ukraine's economy. And with it, the sustainability of Ukrainian society. I think that before Russia would go over to the direct targeting of Ukrainian leadership targets, which, by the way, according to multiple sources, Russia has said they won't do, that it's a special military operation, that they won't take that step. But if Ukraine is linked to this attack, as it appears it will be, then I think the gloves come off and Zelensky and the Ukrainian leadership are targets and they will die. I just don't know if that's going to be tonight. I think that might require because the Russians are very legally minded, it would require some sort of formal transition away from the special military operation into a state of war. And so I think there would have to be some sort of a political play in Russia where Vladimir Putin goes to the Duma, goes to the Federal Assembly, reports to them, gets their permission, then he'll make a declaration, and then Zelensky will die. But again, I'm not a Russian. That's just my assessment.
Finally, Scott, the situation in the UN is going to be highly charged tomorrow. A resolution, bare bones, no frills. Please stop firing now in Gaza. Can the US, in an election year, after all that's happened, really veto that?
I don't think that's the question of the U.S. vetoing it, because the U.S. put forward a resolution that the Russians and the Chinese vetoed last week, because it wasn't a real resolution. It was a fake resolution. The key here is having allowed this veto go to the vote. If the United States was involved in the massaging of this language, then, and the Russians and the Chinese were involved in that, this bare bones language is acceptable, I think this resolution will pass. It has to pass. Biden has no choice but to let it pass, because he's suffering more harm by what's going on in Gaza than he would be by holding Israel to account. The American people are disgusted with what's happening, by and large. And the other thing is, this is becoming a test of America's viability as a world leader. Are we really a nation that has a collar around our neck attached to a leash that's held by the hands of people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem? Because if we allow Israel to continue dictating to us outcomes that are critical to our national security, we are suffering, we being the United States, and I would say Europe by extension, we are suffering so much damage globally in a world that we're going to have to work with when this is done. We're talking about a transition from a singularity of American hegemony to a multipolarity, and everybody, including the Americans, recognizes the inevitability of this transition and the importance of having the United States and Europe in a leadership role. We are losing all credibility around the world because of what Israel is doing in Gaza and our collective unwillingness to hold it to check. So we have no choice but to support this. Now, the real question will be, what happens when Israel says, stick it in your ear? Joe Biden has already said that he will put holding back the supply of weapons on the table. I'd like to see him do that. This becomes an important test of Biden's leadership. And again, this is the kind of test that if you fail, you lose elections. And normally, issues of, foreign policy don't, factor the largest in the American mindset when it comes to an election. James Carville famously said, it's the economy, stupid, back in 1992, to remind Clinton where to put his priority. But in this case right now, given the connectivity between Israel and the American Jewish, American Zionist population, this is a domestic political issue for the United States, and Joe Biden is going to have to stand up and be counted. This is a real test for him, and if he fails it, he lost the election.
Scott Ritter, always a pleasure, a privilege indeed. Thank you very much for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. The legend that is Erobos, Abzu Lamashtu, says we don't have a candidate here in the USA that checks all the necessary boxes. Pro-working class and anti-war. We get one or the other, not both. We need better people to step up. And Ian McKillop says vote Mohammed in Ilford North, Akunji in Bethnal Green, Dent Code in Kensington, Feinstein in Holborn, Gorst in Garston, San in Liverpool, Wavertree, all independents. And last call, I think. We've got time for one more. It's in Los Angeles. It's Christian, who loves the show. Glad to hear it. Christian, welcome to the Mother of All Talk Shows.
You know, I just want to start off being in Los Angeles. You would expect me to be a typical Democrat, but I'm not. I'm a staunch conservative with the Palestinians. And that's a very rare thing to hear about, but there's many of us out there. Unfortunately, with all of the propaganda and the drum beating of war on the right, they usually get sucked into whatever party, whatever faction is the dominant one, in this case being the Israelis over the Palestinians. And there is this almost cognitive dissonance that I've noticed with the Republicans, my fellow once level-headed Republicans, I should say, who they just are apparently ignorant or arrogant or ignorant to the fact, I should say, to Israel's genocide or Israel's 75-year genocide, I should say. As a Ron Paul supporter, which is funny, you guys just talked about Ron Paul and his mention on the Black Swan event. I was one of his delegates for California's slate back in 2012. And so I got to go to the Republican National Convention in Florida representing Ron Paul. I met Tucker Carlson there, which is when he was first starting out to awaken to this entire, systemic problem that we've got going on, specifically with, AIPAC and their control over our government. And it saddens me, George. I don't want to beat the dead horse with a stick. I'm a conservative. I support the Palestinians. There's many of us out there. I've gone to the protests, wearing my MAGA hat. Okay. Yes, wearing my MAGA hat. But, my point is to is to bridge the gap, is to bring both the left and the right, because there's so many things that we agree with, George. And unfortunately, we've got this propaganda machine run by AIPAC, and we all know that, that steers us the wrong way and makes us all look the wrong direction. And I'm just so thankful that you got into this parliament,
Christian.
Man. Thank you.
That was,
God bless you.
That's a wonderful call. Thank you. God bless you. That's a wonderful call to end the show from Christian in Los Angeles. And this is the week in which Candace Owens, because of her questioning of the Israeli narrative, because of her increasing, steadily increasing, aggregating level of consciousness about the truth, about the reality of the Palestinian tragedy and the responsible parties for it, was effectively sacked by the outfit, The Wire, I think it's called, that she was working for and which has now kicked her out. It will turn out, as Piers Morgan once told me, a sacking is a great opportunity. And it will, I'm sure, for Candace Owens, be the opportunity to move into a even higher level of popularity and interest in her work on her own platforms. I'm absolutely certain of that. Just as the sacking of Tucker Carlson kicked him into the stratosphere as the world's most successful, powerful, and presumably best paid broadcasters in the world, it will happen also to Candace Owens. But even Alec Jones of infamy in the InfoWar field has finally tippled, as we say, to the truth. He's finally seen through that you can't really be America first if, in fact, truthfully, you're Israel first. You can't really be for free speech if you are actually in favor of suppressing the freedom of speech of those who support Palestine, who oppose Israel. And thirdly, Tucker Carlson himself, who has been passive and silent, mostly, on the last almost 200 days of disaster, has also, like Owens, like Jones, Tucker Carlson himself has begun to move much closer to a position enunciated by Christian in Florida and as enunciated for fully 50 years by me and by us here at the Mother of All Talk Shows. I sing hallelujah. It's my duty, my job, my mission. It's my mission to win as many people as possible, whatever their previous attitude to the righteousness, the greatness, the centrality of the cause of Palestine, the cause of Gaza, which is the moral center of the world. If you fail the test on the issue of Palestine, on the issue of Gaza, you failed a very important test indeed, on which I believe you will ultimately be judged in this life and the next. I've run out of time. I've ran over time. And I have now to drive to London. So if you'll forgive me, I'll be saying good night to you, but welcoming you, offering an invitation to you to join me again on Wednesday for the midweek Mother of All Talk Shows. I'll be back at 7 o'clock, God willing, on Wednesday. Why don't you come along and bring another viewer with you? Why don't you? Good night.